General, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, you will see that we are succeeding in sticking to our timetable with the military precision which you would expect, which means that we have about 40 minutes for questions and comments. Put your questions either individually or collectively to the Alliance's leadership, but could I ask you before you do so to await the arrival of a mobile microphone, and if you would not mind, to give your name and any organisation you represent. Puis-je vous demander avant de poser vos questions d'attendre l'arrivée d'un microphone portable et d'indiquer votre nom et le cas échéant l'organisation que vous représentez.
My name is Benoît Daboville. I am the French PERM rep. The fourth speaker led gave a lot of importance to the NRF as an agent of transformation, and I think nobody is disagreeing on that. However, when Admiral Jim Bastoni said, and Admiral Jones, that and the Secretary General said that the NRF is not to be a substitute for fourth generation, I think that they were pointing a problem that themselves they have not really addressed after, because if I listen carefully to General Jones, in fact, he was laying the importance of the NRF as a kind of the only permanent force which will be really available at that time, the rest being a bit iffy. And he addressed all his recommendations about funding and so forth, logistics about the NRF, letting the other aspect of fourth generation, other kind of operation, more fuzzy. At the same time, there was a kind of recalling the present debate about forced stabilization and reconstruction operation. So my question is, if you put in phases on reconstruction and stabilization, you are in fact putting in phases on soft military approach, on coordination with civilian operators, on cooperation with other international institutions, fine. But if you put that option in front of Parliament and politicians, they will say, this is excellent, that will please our Parliament, and therefore we will take that out of our defense budget, and we will reduce the element which is for hard option. So in Prague, we made a commitment to develop the hard capability. If now we are shifting to soft, long-staying peacekeeping operation, which are not needing a lot of military capacity, well, of course, communication, intelligence, and so forth, we are really changing priority. What are the consequences of this changing priority in a time where, as it has been said, the prospect for increasing defense spending is not extremely positive? Therefore, within the same budgetary constraint, what do we do? Do we develop the hard edge, or do we invest in the soft edge?
Merci beaucoup, Monsieur l'Ambassadeur. Je crois que c'est faire l'un et l'autre. Je ne serai pas en faveur de l'OTAN seulement utilisant hard power et les autres le soft power. Et je n'ai pas impliqué, je n'ai pas dit que l'OTAN, à l'heure actuelle, devrait faire un investissement séparés pour les forces de stabilisation et de reconstruction. Parce que, à mon avis, c'est toujours une combinaison des deux. Je suis d'accord avec vous, et je l'ai dit, qu'il n'y a pas de question de dire le NRF est maintenant une sorte de substitution pour la génération des forces. C'est pas le cas. Je crois néanmoins que chaque fois qu'on était en train de discuter d'utiliser la NRF ou non, il nous faut une débat, une discussion politique profonde. Mais je n'ai pas dit, je n'ai pas impliqué, et je suis d'accord avec vous, qu'on se concentre sur soft power. Je ne vois pas une division, division of labor entre l'OTAN seulement hard power et par exemple l'Union européenne seulement soft power. L'OTAN n'est pas seulement soft power, la NRF est bien sûr aussi hard power. C'est plus difficile à défendre au Parlement. Ayant été parlementaire pour 16 ans, je sais exactement ce qu'on pense dans les parlements. Néanmoins, la NRF, comme une des choses les plus importantes de la transformation de l'OTAN, ne peut pas rester une sorte d'élément vide des instruments de l'OTAN. Alors pour moi, c'est l'un et l'autre. C'est l'un et l'autre. Et je n'ai pas dit, je n'ai pas impliqué que c'est à l'OTAN maintenant d'organiser une sorte de force de stabilisation, une force de reconstruction. Pas de quoi. À l'autre côté, jamais utiliser la NRF, c'est pas une option. C'est pour ça que j'ai dit, en expliquant le mandat de la NRF, que si on y avait une tsunami, pas en Asie, mais plus près du territoire de l'OTAN, pour ainsi dire, je ne m'en doute pas qu'on aura eu une discussion si on pourrait utiliser la NRF.
I would simply just add that one of my profound convictions over 38 years of wearing a uniform and participating in both combat operations and peacekeeping operations, or if you will, hard and soft operations, is that a well-trained soldier is by definition a well-trained peacekeeper, but the reverse is not true. Thank
you. I would just like to confirm I have the same conviction, and I think it is important to remember again, we're looking for the high end through these lower missions. We are not trying to cut off the high end of this. That's not the intent.
Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Cobbett, Royal United Services Institute. If I could just very briefly comment on the previous question, there's a rather mischievous adage in Britain that says you train for war and you educate for everything else. I have a feeling that there is a danger in that, in the sense that you train for war and you play it off the cuff for everything else. And I think there may be more value in doing more to train specifically for these other operations. But the question is rather different, if I may, and that is that both Secretary General Admiral Giambastiani mentioned the need for better deployability, and General Jones mentioned the common AWACS force as a commonly funding and the value of commonly funding NRF. I wonder if there is value in having a commonly funded deployment force with air and sea elements that would be presumably more efficient in the use of resources, would allow smaller nations to contribute more freely, and would... I would have thought, make force generation a rather more sure process.
Just perhaps one brief remark. Common funding is, of course, a complicated animal. Because if you say we're going to common fund more, and I'm in favor of more common funding, you have to prevent nations going to pay twice. So common funding is inextricably linked. The possibility for more common funding is, in my opinion, inextricably linked to a solution of the general discussion on the cost shares. In other words, who pays what into the alliance's budget? If we have solved that question, I think we can indeed have a discussion on common funding. But in a nation which has a state-of-the-art army or air force, let me mention my own country, the Netherlands, having Apache helicopters, very useful tool in Afghanistan and elsewhere. If you increase common funding and the Netherlands will be asked to send Apaches to Afghanistan at a high price and a high cost, they'll say, hey, listen, friends, fine that we go for more common funding, fine to pay our element of common funding. But I want to see something in return. In other words, first, a solution for the general cost share, which is a debate which is going on at the moment, and then a debate on common funding. I agree, by the way, with General Jones when he says that the AWACS model is a good model to envisage, and I think General Jones implied in his remarks that as far as the elements are concerned you mentioned, we might well seriously consider. But I've given my preconditions for doing that in common funding more of this. But again, with the NRF, you have a fully integrated force, and if you're going to common fund that, at the same time, we have to convince nations of participating in the rotations of the NRF. But I mean, the general thrust of your remarks, I can share. I think, but we have some way to go to get there.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Gerald Blakey. I'm an ancien combattant, but now the editor of Defense Procurement Analysis. A recent analysis of operations in Iraq and Afghanistan indicates that their efficiency was quite severely affected by the technology gap that exists between the United States element and other forces of the coalition, and one must assume that that will affect the NRF. I think this is a question for General Jones. Is this something which worries you? If it does, can you bring pressure to bear on the United States Senate, who, through restrictions in technology transfer, are making this gap wider and accelerating by the day? Thank you.
Thank you. I think one of the byproducts of Prague with the development of the Prague capability commitments was a direct reflection of the fact that we're aware of the technology gap and the alliance wishes to do something about it. But again, this gap is going to be lessened, not by wishful thinking, but by really commitment of resources and long-term pledges that have to be met with regard to each one of those broad capability commitments. So I think there's a direct relationship here between the intent of that was stated in Prague and where we get to. How we get to where we wish to be in 2009, 2010 with regard to those commitments. But Admiral Jim Bastiani really sits astride of both Joint Forces Command and Allied Command transformation and really has, I think, his finger on the pulse of this particular problem. So let me ask him if you'd like to add something.
This is a question that comes up in repetitively every forum we speak and deal in. And what I would tell you is that, first of all, the fact that NATO and the U.S. have agreed to dual hat the commander of United States Joint Forces Command as also SAC-T is an important fact. The U.S. has invested a significant amount of money in how to conduct coherent joint operations, is the way I'll describe it. And in fact, we are running with an experimentation budget in the United States of somewhere around $175 million, whereas the experimentation budget in NATO just 2 years ago was running probably at about €1 million. And today it's running at about 17 million, which is wonderful because we've just created this command. And the intent to put these organizations together is to help deliver frankly, technology both ways, through the alliance and in return. Now, let me give you one example. Recently here, we've taken a requirement from the operators, General Jones and staff, to understand situational awareness over long geographic distances, such as in Afghanistan. So a classic example of that is that we took a look at, if you will, a satellite-based system that would be usable for NATO forces. And we experimented with it under Lieutenant General Pease's command of the International Security Assistance Force, and we completed that experiment at the end of December of last year. And we call that experiment a NATO-friendly force tracker. And what we did is we took a significant capability, frankly, that the U.S. has for combat forces down to the lowest entity level, which is an individual soldier, Marine, or Special Forces operator. And brought that to NATO across a very broad expanse in Afghanistan. That's a classic example of this that we're using in the experimentation program. So, frankly, the alliance's commitment with regard to experimentation and creating a better connection between the military and the industrial sides of the alliance is important. Seated over here to my left, about halfway back, raise your hand there, Xavier, is Rear Admiral Xavier Pitar. Now, he spends his time in an organization called Future Capabilities Research and Technology, and we work with the Research and Technology Agency, but we've started industrial ties here across the alliance. And without spending a long time answering this any further, I would just say to you that bringing technology in a two-way street between the alliance and in particular in the United States, but frankly across the entire group, because there are so many good things out there, in a coherent and integrated way that all of our forces can use is important. That's why you see the Secretary General, General Jones, and I keep hammering on common capabilities. In many cases, it's not so much a technology gap as it is a fact that you have to bring large groups of these forces together with common capabilities. If you don't do that, you're not going to be successful when you try to do coherent, integrated military alliance operations.
I can add, sir, that for a NATO Secretary General, it's always useful to go to the Hill in Washington to discuss with the Senate, because that was the political volet of your question. Patents and other ways we could increase, or they could increase, the possibility of technology transfer. That's definitely a very interesting subject of discussion on the Hill in Washington. So there, I agree with you.
Thank you, Chairman Nauman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General Nauman, former chairman of the Military Committee. I was quite pleased to hear what you, Secretary General, and the two strategic commanders had to say about the implementation of the NATO Response Force, which I understand as a hub of transformation of NATO other forces. But still believing that military forces have to serve a political objective at the end of the day, I wonder whether the two objectives, which we presumably all have in mind, are really met if we look at the NRF. The first objective is to express the principle to share risks among the allies and to achieve influence on each other's decision-making. That may be achieved as long as we stick to the principle that the NRF has to be ready for the high combat mission as well as for other missions. And I fully agree with what the two commanders said. A good fighter is also a good peacekeeper, but never the other way around. But if the other objective is to impress those who are the bad guys. And if I look at the bad guys in our world, I wonder whether they are too mightily impressed by what we call the NATO Response Force. It's a force which, if I look at the European contributions, is primarily a force composed of more or less extant forces with some marginal improvements. There's a gap of interoperability between the European contributions and the American capabilities. And if I understand the principle of future conflicts, high-intensity conflicts properly, then the decisive edge will be achieved if you have information superiority, information dominance, and link it to the ability to strike with great precision at any distance of your liking. Where are the capabilities in this category? And are we really right to be satisfied with what we have with the NIF right now? Or should we not look at some, let's say, commonly funded, commonly operated, commonly procured capabilities in the area of information dominance linked to precision strike? And I would appreciate if I could get your comments. Thank you.
Sure. Klaus, one way I would describe the second half of the equation, we have a few chiefs of defense in the audience here, and I think each country always knows that each parliament or Congress is going to allot a certain amount of funds for national security in general. And as you do commonly funded activities, they see their top line or national capability being decremented. So there's always a tension in each ministry, in each chief of defense, as you well know, in how much of this can I handle and still be able to perform the national missions that are given. That tension is always going to rise. Every time parliamentary members come and visit Allied Command Transformation, we get into this discussion. But what I would suggest to you that you can hear by, I think, the comments of the three of us up here, that as alliance officers and as a Secretary General, we are very much in the mode that if you want to conduct integrated alliance operations, you have to stress these common issues and extending them beyond just generated forces to the NRF makes great sense. Let me give you an example that we haven't talked about here. But in the United States, we're moving towards, if you will, commonly funded command and control system. One, I think, should extend this and think about extending this to NATO, just as though it was an air refueling or a transport or a sea lift capability, some type of common fund, so that every time you train to common standards and use a common command and control system, for example, for NATO, it would make great sense. We have some of that already, but I suspect that more of it would be better for future operations. That's the way I'd answer the second part of your question. Jim?
General Nauman, thank you for that question. And I think the issue of deterrence to the bad guys, for example, is part and parcel of what I was trying to get at in terms of what is our philosophical orientation and what is our willingness with regard to this force, which now, ladies and gentlemen, amounts to about 25,000 troops per rotation. So at any one time, the NATO response force has about 75,000 troops involved in some aspect of the life cycle of the NRF, either preparing to be trained and certified, being on the standby, and then just coming off of its watch. As exciting as the NRF is, there are definitely some challenges associated with it, and time will tell whether we are able to meet those challenges. One is, of course, how you use it. But specifically, we have to, in my opinion, we have to bring some greater capability and coherence and stability to the NRF in terms of how it's commanded and controlled. This is a debate that we will have, discussion we'll have in the upcoming MCCS next month with the Chiefs of Defense. But we do have a lot of data in now. Joint Force Command in Brunson has commanded the NRF for a year. The Joint Force Commander in Naples is now in command of the NRF. We have an operation ongoing in the Canary Islands. And we're moving towards full operational capability exercises next year. I think it's important that that within each operational headquarters, that we have a deployable joint task force headquarters that is intimately tied to the NRF with a ready DJTF that can in fact move out at short notice with whatever the NRF mission is. I think it's important that everybody understands that the likelihood of all 25,000 members of the NRF being deployed at the same time is extremely slim, but highly probable that the NRF could be used in different types of missions simultaneously, spread over the different joint commanders, the operational commanders. It's quite possible you could have an NRF forces working for our commander in Brunson and our commander in Naples simultaneously doing different things. What the NRF brings you is is great flexibility in a short period of time and across an expeditionary bandwidth. It is not a substitute for follow-on forces. Its charter is to be able to deploy quickly and be able to sustain itself once there, wherever that is, until follow-on forces arrive if that's required. And so as such, there are some shortfalls in the key enablers, the critical things that I think that we need to bring to the NRF in order to make it achieve its full potential. And those include, as I mentioned in my prepared remarks, some planning capabilities that have to be highly developed, some intelligence and information management capabilities embedded in the NRF. You can't, I think it would be irresponsible to deploy the NRF without an intelligence capability in a high threat environment. I think that's that would be that we could not recommend that to the alliance. A better integrated multinational logistics capability for the expeditionary nature of the NRF, certainly out to 16, maybe to 120 days, I think makes good sense. We have a lack, obviously, of organic strategic airlift. We are dependent on contract lift, but perhaps we could consider perhaps a leasing capability like we embedded in within NATO AWACS of having some organic airlift. That's something that certainly has a price tag associated with it, but if we're serious about wanting to be able to lift our forces to any part, anywhere we wish to go within 5 days of notification, we have to have that capability. That's not there presently. And lastly, I think I come back around that nothing's free, and I think we have to have some agility in how we fund NRF operations. And Secretary General pointed out some of those challenges, and those challenges are real. But I think the built-in capability and utility that's found in the NRF is an achievable thing for the alliance. We shouldn't be afraid of this. This is a dynamically new capability. It doesn't mean that the other alliance capabilities are any less important or any less subject to transformational change, if you will. But I think it does give us a chance to inculcate in this very important capability some transformational ideas that will then populate the alliance. We've touched on some of those. We look forward to continuing this discussion.
Just one word, General Norman. Your first two sentences were as important as the rest, because you started by saying it's sharing risks and influence each other's decision-making. And that is exactly the point I was trying to make on the NRF and the debate we should have. Because before, I mean, it's up to the strategic commanders advising the council either or not to deploy the NRF. We will have the political debate about the NRF, and we'll do that in this alliance in consensus. That's an important principle, as you know very well, and it will stay, as far as I'm concerned, a very important principle. And that's why we need this political debate as well. And that drives me in my ambition to see the political debate even more taking hold in the alliance. Because first of all, it is a political decision to confront the bad guys. How you do it, with what you do it, very relevant. Lift, as mentioned by General Jones. We should really redress the situation that if we want to fly a battalion into Afghanistan for electoral support, we need U.S. enablers. We need U.S. C-17s to get them in. I think that's an imbalance in this alliance. We really have to redress. Let's not forget the political element of this, and that's the important question. Not using the NRF as a substitute for force generation, because then we'll know what will happen. Countries will sit back if they don't participate in a rotation of the NRF. And the others say, let's not participate in the way we're doing now, because we might be called upon all the time. That's a fine balance we have to strike, without losing the NRF as the main concept and the main drive of transformation. So I do not belong to those who say, let's shelve it, because not ever using it is losing it. I mean, it's a cheap one-liner, but I hope you know what I mean. On the other hand, not the conclusion, we have the NRF, so force generation as a problem is over. That's nonsensical, of course. First of all, because you need the follow-on force, and secondly, you need the solidarity, and then I'm back with the risk-sharing in this alliance, that it is not only the countries who participate in an NRF rotation who bear the burden, but others as well. Risk-sharing and influence each other's decision-making. That's indeed, as far as I'm concerned, the core and the heart of the matter.
If I could just a couple of follow-on points. Sorry, I didn't think about this earlier. One point is that I think it's very important that the NRF membership and participation be open to all nations in the alliance. And I think that the only way you can do that is to make sure that we have the funding mechanisms to make sure that it's not that the pain is shared across the boards. But I don't think that I think everybody can make a contribution, and whether it's a niche contribution or a major contribution, but nobody should be discouraged from or have some disincentives from participating. The second point I would make, and it comes back to why funding reform is so important, is there is a direct relationship between the appetite that we all have to fund missions and the probability that the missions will actually take place. In other words, if you look at our NRF generation, force generation, we've had great success at generating those rotations where the NRF is not going to be employed. And that's because under the false cost fall where they lie system, the bills come when you actually use the force. So And this is why I use the analogy of let's be careful that we don't make the NRF a nuclear deterrent capability, because you build it, you put it on the shelf, and you never use it. NRF 7 rotation will be the NRF that will do the LiveX 06 next year for the full operational capability test of the NRF. And it's going to be at a strategic distance. It's going to be challenging. It's going to take time. It's not going to be a 25,000-man exercise. It'll be appropriately sized to test the elements of the NRF. But under the current funding mechanism, under cost fall where they lie, nations who participate in NRF 7 will generally pick up the bill for the exercise. And understandably, people wish to know how much that's going to be and what exactly is entailed. And so if you look at the fourth generation matrix for NRF 5 and 6, we're doing great. NRF 4, no problem. NRF 7, we have a lot of holes. And this is why some flexibility and agility in the funding mechanism for the NRF to reach its full potential is very important.
If I could just put a period on this, on the second part of your point, General Nauman, you talked about these common capabilities for the NRF, and you could extend those on to the other. Let me just say that nations and NATO have stepped up in the form of creating the Joint Warfare Center and now the Joint Force Training Center. Chiefs of Defense have invested very good people and are investing very good people to populate these two centers. And the North Atlantic Council has approved the capability packages for creation of these. We're out using these. And why is this important? Because they train headquarters elements to common standards and certification, if you will, General Jones and I do together. It's an Allied Command Transformation series of organizations, but General Jones is the final certifying authority for these headquarters, and this is very important, and they're training each of the deploying units that go to ISAF, for example, each of these headquarters units for the NRF. This is very important, and it truly is a common capability that all the nations have come together. So I'm very pleased with the fast-tracking of both personnel and capabilities.
Our time's almost up, but we've got, I think we can fit in just one more question if it's a fairly brief one. Second row.
Good morning. My name is Jerry Halton, and I'm the Dean of the School of Technology Management at Stevens Institute. But I was Undersecretary of the Navy for 3 years and served with both the Admiral and the General. As you know, I spent a fair amount of time in that service bringing business practices into the Pentagon and the military. But I would like to offer that I think there's an opportunity for bringing military practices into the civilian ambit in this fashion, that a good bit of what we're talking about on the soft power side, civilian stabilization, and even into net-centric operations, information operations, transformation, does not suffer from a technological imbalance. That is, there's no dominance of the U.S. in these areas. In fact, Europe has been very interested in questions of how to handle relationships, how to grow, how to develop the rest of the world. So it seems to me that in these areas, the science and technology that NATO invests in could have real integration into the European system, and in addition, the education that's needed to create officers and enlisted men and women who can serve in these fashions is the very same kind of education that might be very helpful to be provided by civilian institutions to a number of people beyond the military. Seeming that linkage then leads to a greater understanding of the both military and political role of NATO, deeper integration into society, a stronger Europe and a stronger relationship across the Atlantic. And I'd be interested in your thoughts as to whether or not this is an opportunity for NATO to integrate itself more fully into the political system in Europe.
Well, thank you, sir. That of course, has a relationship, I hope, and I think, to the remarks I've been making in my speech on the importance of NATO-EU cooperation and a wider NATO-EU agenda. A few remarks. First, to repeat that we should not have a situation, as I said in answering Ambassador Dubovil's remarks, that we would go for a situation where NATO would be using and applying the hard power and the European Union the soft power. I think that's not a correct division of labor. So if we discuss, indeed, let's say the high end of the military spectrum on the one hand and stabilization reconstruction activities on the other hand, I think it should be a joint exercise, and I'm not advocating NATO to set up. I think, as I said in response to an earlier question, that NATO should set up a separate force for peace building and reconstruction. I think we have enough on our plate as far as transformation is concerned. Nevertheless, having said that, there is a great possibility in NATO's relationships with the European Union to enhance cooperation. And I think still Afghanistan is a case in point, in the sense that we have the provincial reconstruction team concept there, and that the EU has experience in reconstructing or setting up a judicial system, training prison wards, setting up a prison system, all those kind of things. But it should logically follow from what NATO can do or from what NATO does. So in my opinion, there's two sides of the same coin. But politically, I think it's important that we do not get a division of labor between the hard power and the soft power. The NATO allies and the European Union members, and let's not forget, I mean, 19 EU members are members of NATO. And the same amount is NATO membership in the European Union. But I would not see that division of labor develop because that will lead to wrong conclusions in parliaments and in parliamentary public opinion, because every parliament and every government, and I have some experience with that personally, of course will go for the soft power. it's easier to have a provincial reconstruction team in Afghanistan than it is to hunt Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Let's face the facts. I'm not blaming anybody here specifically, but we need this large agenda. Last year we had a conference with NGOs in the NATO headquarters on the PRT concept and on Afghanistan, and some NGOs were critical because they say the military are doing our work. We don't need military protection. We can much better do our work without military protection. Yesterday we had the director of the ICRC, Dr. Kellenberger, when we had our European Atlantic Partnership Council. It raises a lot of questions, but let's not forget that NATO should always be able to do the fighting. I mean, that's a less attractive message, of course, but NATO should always be able to do the fighting and operate in the high end of the military spectrum. That NATO is doing other things in Afghanistan, that NATO forces in KFOR, after the General Jones referred to it, after the unfortunate upsurge in ethnic violence late March, is also making a point of training the soldiers in riot control. I mean, there should be something between the baton and the bullet. And the KFOR commander was last year in a position that he, in many instances, did not have anything between the baton and the bullet. We should train our forces for riot control, because also in what is a peacekeeping operation in Kosovo, they can be confronted with things in the many decades of NATO's existence soldiers and military men and commanders have never been confronted with. So it's a multifaceted approach I'm advocating, if we do not forget that NATO should be able to operate in the complete military spectrum and not only in one part of it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now out of time. My apologies to those who would have liked to put a question. Could you please, we break for coffee, could you please be back here prompt at 11:15 for the next session, which will be chaired by the Secretary General and will feature the defence ministers of Bulgaria, Lithuania and Denmark. But could I ask you first to give our thanks to our three speakers, to the Secretary General, to the two Supreme Commanders.